our security officer called me on the phone and he said, I have to tell you that Nils has been shot and we think that he's dead. I mean, he was quite blunt and not trying to smooth the message.
Cilla Benko, Director General of Swedish Radio, recalls the day in March 2014 when she learned that Nils Horner, a correspondent in Afghanistan, had been shot dead.
The first thing I actually did was that I closed my door to my little office and I just screamed, damn, 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 because I just needed to get it out of my system. And then I realized, well, this is going to be the most important day of your life, most likely. So you have to handle it well. And I went into my management team and I said to them, sorry, it's not going to be a normal management team meeting. We are now a crisis team.
Threats to journalists are everywhere. While assassinations like Nils Horner's are perhaps more rare, in some parts of the world, reporters face threats of kidnapping and bodily harm while doing their jobs. And increasingly, journalists everywhere are facing harassment, both in person and online. Editors and managers must be on the front lines to keep them safe. But this isn't always the case. Safety takes anticipation, training, planning, and investment. How do you make it a priority rather than an afterthought? This is The Backstory, a podcast from WANIFRA, the World Association of News Publishers. I'm Andy Heslop, WANIFRA's Press Freedom Director. This season, in 6 episodes, we'll be going deep into safety. What journalists, editors, and the public should be thinking about to stay safe in a world increasingly hostile to the press. This episode, Managing Safety. If journalism protects democracy, then who's protecting journalists? The important role editors and managers play in keeping their reporters safe.
Bang!
Where is it coming from?
Get down!
For many of the journalists here in Entebbe, just outside of Kampala, the capital of Uganda, this hostile environment training course is the first time they've ever really thought about safety in the field.
There isn't any.
No bleeding.
Airways, clear.
Over 3 days, 19 journalists and editors from around the country learned the basics of first aid, anticipating the environment and coming up with communications plans with their newsrooms.
Your breath?
I think by sheer luck I've survived, but I wasn't aware before.
Desire Mbabali is a freelance reporter. She'd never thought much about safety, even though she's covered some tense situations. She recalls a demonstration at a university that turned violent.
I had to start running together with the students who were rioting because police had started firing tear gas and live bullets, you know. So it was a risky situation. I just used instinctive survival tricks, but I didn't know what to do. So to me, the training has given me skills to think about my safety, especially the planning bit. Think about your escape routes. Think about your emergency. Think about how can you survive. Previously, I didn't put any thought into it. So I'll just do, just a quick background research, but not about my safety.
It's actually quite hard to hit a target down low. So good, well done.
Individual reporters need training to anticipate and plan for potential risks while on assignment. But they're individuals. Carol Bianga, managing editor for digital platforms for the Daily Monitor, says the training course got her thinking about processes on an institutional level. Making sure individual journalists are prepared is one thing, getting editors on board is quite another.
What I want to do is speak to the editors because I work with them on a daily basis. So every day that someone goes to the field, I speak with the editor and say, okay, who has gone? Whom are you sending? And then they let me know. So I'll also be asking them regularly, do you have this? Do you know that? Do you know which phone he's going to use? Do they have a plan for if things get bad? But going forward, also start to talk to editors and ask them, can we do a small, you know, security plan? It's a good thing, but I've seen how we've done plans. You know, it's like the first few days, everyone is yes, and they're working on them, but after some time, someone slips up. So for me, that I think it needs to be very practical. We need to ensure that every morning that people are going through their security plan. So I would like that the editor every day is asking and saying, what's his security plan? How are we going to do this?
When Nils Horner was killed in 2014, Swedish Radio did have a robust safety and security plan in place. When Horner prepared to cover the Afghan elections, they stuck to it.
Ahead of the assignment, three people conducted a risk assessment. Horner himself, along with his immediate editor, in this case, the foreign editor, plus Swedish Radio has on-staff safety advisors. Horner was an experienced foreign correspondent. He'd gone through several safety training courses and the assignment was relatively straightforward. Sure, Kabul was a dangerous place, but there'd been no major attacks in the run-up to the election. Despite all of that, he was shot in the head by two people on a relatively safe street. Sila Benko, speaking to producer Sarah Elsas, said the team went over what they could have done differently.
We, of course, went through and really looked at the safety procedures. Did we miss anything? Did we do a misjudgment? We couldn't find anything. But, of course, after that, we added even more, you know, safety measures, even more training, asking maybe two or three or four questions more before we come to a decision. I mean, really trying to make even more.
Because there's always this balance, right, between safety precautions, but also covering what needs to be covered, even if it is in a dangerous part of the world.
And we have had other incidents. I mean, we had a journalist being shot at in covering Iraq also. I mean, so I mean, things do happen, and we are quite aware that things will happen again. What we are trying to avoid is, of course, getting either our member of staff killed or kidnapped. But actually, we do have staff that rather want to go than not want to go, which means that we sometimes have to say, no, you're not going to go.
What are the responsibilities of the editor and the managers when you're accepting pitches or assigning stories? What are the responsibilities of that editor?
The three people that are doing the safety assessment is the journalists who are on the field. And of course, they are the best ones to actually judge the situation. Then it's also their closest manager, who's also been a foreign correspondent. And she knows them as a person, which means that on a certain assignment, we would send one foreign correspondent, but maybe not another, because they're not as experienced. They have not gone through exactly the same things. And I know when you actually say that you want to go, but I can hear on your voice that maybe you are a bit reluctant. That could also happen. And then we have the security officer, and he looks at facts. Facts assessments from that we have ourselves, from third parties, from other big companies. And then he comes up with, you know, has there been any incidents recently? What have they been about? What can happen? And very often it's not go or no go. Sometimes it's something in between, you know, that we say, yes, you can go, but you should strictly stay within these boundaries. If you want to travel to another city within the country, we need to do a new assessment and so on and so on.
So the editor's job in this is to really read the person and to be really responsive both to the person's experience, but also the way they're talking about it and the way they're presenting things.
Yeah, but also knowing the business, knowing, following news, following what other correspondents are covering from different areas. So the closest manager of the foreign correspondents, she knows them as persons, but she also, of course, are following constantly what's going on in the world to be able to make an assessment on her own. Is this a place where the story is so important that we really should send someone in there?
Is there a need in a newsroom for a dedicated security person or personnel?
It depends on how big you are. It depends on how many high-risk assignments you do. But also, we could see that actually also nationally now, journalists are becoming more of a target, also in Sweden. So, I mean, of course, it's always a matter of how small you are. But if you don't, I mean, you could always be part of an international network. And that's the reason for why we are also being part of INSEE, the International News and Safety Organization in London, because that gives us, through a very small membership fee, access to all the big guys. I mean, we can take part of the security and safety assessments that have been done by other big news organizations. Of course, they're done out of their perspective and not out of our perspective, being a small radio-only broadcaster traveling with just one person speaking Swedish. But still, you could build your own knowledge with them and use them when you make your own assessment.
Your foreign correspondents are more or less all on staff. How is it different dealing with staffers versus freelancers in terms of the responsibility of a manager, of an editor?
Well, we say that we have the same responsibility, and we don't buy things from a freelancer who wants to work for more employers than one at the time. So, for instance, we had a freelancer doing stories on our behalf from a certain part of Iraq. Then we paid him well enough so that he only went there on behalf of us, because then we couldn't control the safety procedures.
It's a rare decision to make. Not many news organizations do that.
No, but we have made a very clear strategical decision that we think that foreign coverage is very important. And of course, it's very expensive. As a manager, you have to dedicate money to it. Otherwise, you shouldn't send out staff. I mean, you can't send your employees to high-risk areas and say, but I can't afford to do the security assessment. I mean, that's just not possible.
Swedish radio is an example of a newsroom that has internalized the culture of safety, something not enough newsrooms are doing. Most news organizations don't have safety policies and protocols in place, and they only address safety when there are problems or in times of crisis. That's the case in Colombia, where journalists regularly face danger in covering guerrilla groups, armed conflicts, and drug trafficking. Luisa Fernanda Izaza says journalists often work without much safety training or support from their newsrooms. She's the coordinator for the defense and support of journalists at FLEEP, Colombia's Press Freedom Foundation, which has recently started shifting away from helping individual journalists to supporting entire newsrooms. Izaza recalls events in May of 2016, when a well-known journalist was kidnapped in northeastern Colombia.
So she was kidnapped by a guerrilla group. And since this was national news, two local offices of big national news outlets told their journalists, you have to go cover this story. A journalist and his cameraman said, like, hey, this area is very risky. We should not go there. And their editor was like, you're not forced to do this. You're a freelance journalist. There are other people willing to go do this, and we should just like continue working with them in the future. So, of course, they felt this pressure and decided to go cover the story, and they got kidnapped also. We realized that the media outlets were neglecting the protection of their own journalists. One would think, like a country that has suffered so much, all the news outlets are prepared for this, but sadly that is not the case.
So how do you get media outlets to pay attention to safety? Philippe thought about the problem and decided one way was to start involving everyone in their safety courses.
The editors and the managers have to be in the same process. So they have to be present while we are in the physical safety training. When we're speaking about digital safety, they have to be there. When we're speaking about what we're going to do about resources, like actually money, because part of the reason why journalists were not changing their ways and were not adopting measures was money.
If the big problem is, in particular in Colombia, there isn't what you were calling this culture of safety, the most difficult part in all of this is not so much the training, is convincing a newsroom, an editor, a manager, an owner, that they should take this training and invest the time and the resources into this training in the first place, right?
Yeah, so part of the work that we're doing is to raise awareness among the editors and the managers. So the beginning of the process, we remind them about the aggressions that the news outlet itself had suffered along the year, or of the aggressions that other news outlets in the same region had suffered. Also, we try to make them aware of how this is not just spending money, this is investing in their reputation, in the protection of their journalists. It doesn't look good if after your journalist is kidnapped, there are news outlets saying that your journalist had said that he didn't want to go cover that story. So of course, if something happens, but the news outlet says, hey, we had a plan, we reacted fast, we had life insurance for our journalists, those are things that look good, and media outlets worry about that.
All of this does cost money and it costs time. What are we talking about in terms of investment?
So this involves having money for paying, for example, press vests or t-shirts for their journalists to be identified when they are covering certain areas. But it's not just that. It doesn't end there. They should also, for example, if they can, have life insurances. And actually, one of the things that we request for them in the certifications program is to have an emergency resources policy in case something happens. That's a conversation that it's actually part of our program. That is exactly one of those things that wasn't happening just training journalists. If there is not a money commitment from the managers, then many of these things just won't happen. Like, yeah, it's wonderful if you could have a life insurance, we say to the journalists, but they're like, hey, I just don't have the money to pay for that. So that's what we're trying to do when we involve the managers and the editors in the process.
Money is key to safety, and we'll be addressing that further in a future episode. Training courses cost money. Risk assessments take time. Some organizations, like Swedish Radio, decide to invest in on-staff security personnel. But all of that is a luxury for smaller, underfunded news organizations. For example, Luisa Fernanda Izasa says she knows of no Colombian newsrooms with dedicated security personnel. So what do you do if you're an editor or a manager, and you don't necessarily have the resources for security personnel, but nevertheless you want to up your focus on security?
The good news is a lot of it is common sense, and I don't think all organizations need to have a security advisor. There's going to be some specialist knowledge involved for equipment or, you know, other places for foreign travel. There can be, there'll be some value of particular knowledge sets, but much of it anybody can do or put together just by doing a little bit of research.
Elliot Stempf is an on-staff security consultant and the head of high risk for BuzzFeed. He works with reporters and editors to develop stories that involve higher risk, aftermaths of natural disasters, investigative or adversarial reporting. But he says editors on their own can and should be bringing up security in discussions of any assignment, even if the conclusion is that there is no security risk. It doesn't need to be complicated, but it does require some thinking.
What I often recommend to all reporters putting together risk assessments, and I think it's good for editors to be thinking along these lines too, is to rather than think about risk in the abstract sense for any assignment, rather than thinking about the crime rates in a particular area or the risk of certain types of conflict in Syria or Iraq, say, is to sort of reverse that inside out and start with the reporter's identity. And say, what happens when the reporter's identity makes contact with the story? In terms of identity, you know, we want to be looking at someone's age, someone's ethnicity, someone's gender, someone's past experiences with reporting on that story. And so there is, for pretty much for any individual working on a story, it's how all these individual elements play with the story itself that is going to decide how you're going to approach the story.
So in this risk assessment, then, it's a risk assessment to what end? Once you sit down, say, with an editor and a reporter, and you talk about all these things on an individual level and you look at the general context, what's the conclusion?
For me, I don't think the end should ever be a binary yes or no. And certainly there is going to be some stories which you say, you know what, the risk of this sort of event happening is just too high. That story exists. Is it a story that we very often encounter? No. It's an extreme situation, and I don't want that extreme situation to define the discourse. What I want to focus on is instead is kind of that wide breadth of stories in the gray, which can be risky, but with a little thought and some protocols, a lot of those threats can be reduced. That's being sure that folks have proper accreditation. That means, you know, making sure there's appropriate insurance in place. That means having that communications plan. And more important than saying when we're going to do check-ins is going to articulate what happens when a check-in is missed. I know many teams of people that have set up check-ins but just have never responded after the check-ins were missed, which defeats the entire purpose of the idea. Another topic that comes up often as well that requires some decision-making is looking at the outcome of the story once it's published. Oftentimes, the reporting of a story might be quite straightforward. However, once the story is released, it can lead to increased risk to either a reporter or the individuals the reporters worked with on the ground, particularly fixers, drivers, or photojournalists. And so it's essential to be also thinking about what are our plans for those individuals if the story runs into issues. for reporters who are doing higher risk work in their own cities or towns, it's much more complicated on how to maintain their security day in, day out. From an editor's standpoint, one of the first things I want to flag is the reporter's own psychosocial well-being, because it can be extremely taxing.
These are things I think that everybody does think about. And when you ask them, you know, is safety important? They'll say, of course it is. But then you see these situations that happen over and over again where the story trumps the safety for whatever reason.
Well, no, I think it's important not to see these two, the story and safety, as in sort of this antagonistic relationship. Reporters take risks, right? And for many stories. And so the idea that we don't always do the safest thing, that's extremely normal. And so I think driving the conversation towards what is our strategy for the story? How can we pursue this story in an aggressive way that allows this reporter in this newsroom to continue to do this kind of reporting day after day? And so that is necessarily going to mean taking into account the reporter and their relationship with the story. That's going to necessarily include concepts of, hey, maybe we're going to need specific PPE, body armor things for this story, or we need a different communications plan, or we need to think more deeply about who this individual reporter is going to be working with on the ground. I think once you put it in the context of strategy and pursuit of the story via resilience, it creates the framework for allowing all these questions to come out that we need to be asking.
Having the safety conversation is an important step towards addressing it. But practically, what can you do as a journalist or an editor to put in place safety protocols? Elizabeth Cantens, the director of the ACOS Alliance, which works to support journalists and media organizations to embrace a culture of safety, has some tips. Speaking to producer Mariona Sanz, she says building safety procedures starts with thinking through what you need to think about.
Before you elaborate your policy and protocols, you understand the nature of your organization. You analyze the threats you encountered in the past. You understand the type of reporting that you're doing now. And based on these, you can define your institutional tolerance for risk and have a better sense of what you need to put in place.
Between editors and reporters, who's responsible for what?
Well, that's exactly what your policy and protocols will define, will bring clarity. And clarity means that you're able to implement. An example, an editor will be responsible for giving a green light before a dangerous assignment, will be assessing the editorial value against risks, will make executive decisions when there is an emergency crisis or when issue arise. While the journalist will be in charge of elaborating a risk assessment and a communications plan, I really believe that's something that the reporter needs to create. Then will be discussed with the editor or the producer, which will provide input, but ultimately needs to come from the journalist. So everyone has its own shared of responsibility in that newsroom, and there needs to be a complicity working as a team.
How can you ensure that after safety training, there is this development of the protocols and that there is follow-up after the training and these protocols don't end up in a shelf and never get used?
When you are elaborating your protocols, don't forget to update them. This is an alive document. It needs to be regularly reviewed and updated. So you need to incorporate what we call postmortems. So what went right and wrong after a risky assignment? What were the lessons learned? These are all very important, because actually what we're aiming for is for an ongoing conversation, something that it's integrated into content production. Because it's true, safety adds an extra layer of work, but it becomes more manageable and makes more sense when it goes hand in hand with content production. Some very journalistic questions have an essential safety dimension. For example, why are we doing this story? Who is doing it? I think some editors fear that having a process in place will limit their ability to do their job, and that's quite the opposite. Protocols should help facilitate difficult work and decision-making. And this is about how we can do our work in the most professional way. So it's about enabling and not restricting. Don't be afraid that that's going to be a barrier when you do your work.
There are plenty of resources out there to help facilitate these conversations and get protocols going. For example, the ACOS Alliance recently released a newsroom safety self-assessment, while international organizations can also provide risk profiles. You can find more of these resources on the Press Freedom section of the WANIFRA website. That's wan-ifra.org. In future episodes of this series on safety, we'll be looking into the practicalities of cost and contracts, and the impacts dealing with trauma, online harassment, and gender-based violence. Please subscribe to The Backstory to hear each episode as soon as it's released. Find us on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening, and remember, until next time, stay safe.